You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of For the Sake of Argument by Chris Murphy. Good faith or bad, Jubilee's reach is undeniable. It was very striking, not just the number of people who saw it, but the people who saw it were often people who didn't see the other things I did, says Buttigieg. This is during a month when I might have done a dozen or more major TV appearances. Some young people would come up to me and say, I saw you on this thing, in a way that made it clear to me that they hadn't seen any of those others. But even now, the former transportation secretary says, elected officials and strategists give him a blank look when he asks if they've heard of Jubilee. They say no, and I say, well, I didn't either. And it turns out it's got way more viewership than a lot of TV shows that you do know. As one may expect, Jubilee primarily reaches young people. Gen Xers who participate in Surrounded often say that they had no idea what Jubilee was before they agreed to make content for it. I got this request to do it, says Sater. My daughter was home for Christmas break. She's a college student. And I'm like, have you ever heard of this Jubilee thing? And she's like, you have to do it. I think young people are so interested and invested in Jubilee because a lot of what they see around them is not that, says Lee. Everything from politics to even shows and other things, it's so scripted or it's so controlled. And I think that that's something that we're really excited about. Jubilee also practices what it preaches. Lee estimates that the team is primarily composed of Zoomers, while Crooks says the average age for employees is 24 years old. Detractors accuse Jubilee of memifying political discourse by posting transparent rage bait, content designed not to build bridges, but rather to feed an insatiable algorithm that thrives on conflict. Surrounded videos, they say, are created with the intention of inflaming emotions and sowing division, all for clicks and cash. Lee doesn't see it that way. Certainly the algorithm has a part to play, he says, but we think that the problem and the root is far deeper, and part of it is the lost ability to have discourse. We've lost the ability or the courage to sit in discomfort even. But if we think about the human experience, we have to bump into each other. Lee means that literally. He thinks the company's future is in live events, like a recent in-person dating experience at UCLA that drew almost 1,000 students. He expects Jubilee to produce its first live Surrounded, complete with studio audience, in the next 12 to 18 months. I suspect that by end of spring, we'll do an entire college tour, Lee says. Kirk lost his life on just such a tour. But Lee doesn't seem overly concerned about the potential safety issues. We want to create content, experiences, even technology that brings people together, he says. In moments like this, he sounds a lot like Mark Zuckerberg, another founder with purportedly earnest aims. We all know how that's turned out. Sater, too, is skeptical, not of the live event strategy, but Lee's theory of human connection. I think this country is polarized, and I don't think people will be brought together by YouTube, he says. And while his own experience was positive-ish, he's not sure whether he'd recommend another commentator work with Jubilee in the wake of Hassan's episode. The casting is a real problem, he says. Making another video with Lee's company is not impossible for me to imagine, but I would need assurances about the vetting. Potentially, I would be up for doing it again, says Buttigieg. For all of the thousands of interviews that I've done, this was a pretty formative one in terms of my understanding of the new media landscape, and one that has stuck with me as one of the most important and interesting that I did in that entire political cycle. Perhaps he should be careful what he wishes for. Lee tells me Jubilee already has eyes on the 2028 election and hopes that his company will moderate an actual, real-deal debate among White House hopefuls. I think there's a reason why young people are no longer tuning in to these presidential debates, he says. People value politicians who can engage and speak clearly, directly to their audiences. And I think that that's why Jubilee is really well poised and the perfect partner. That's hilarious, Hassan says when I tell him this. But he knows too much to laugh too loud or for too long. I mean, look, we live in America, he says. It could happen. I wouldn't be surprised. On the topic of new money, you bet your life. Prediction markets like Kalshi and Polymarket entice enterprising nerds to make and lose fortunes by wagering on everything from politics to the weather. Zoe Bernard explains why they're unstoppable and only getting more powerful. Opening illustration by Chantal Jacquin, which shows an old-fashioned 8-ball toy with the message, "Yes, buy, 29 cents. With various posed questions like, U.S. gas prices up this week? Will the U.S. take control of Greenland? Will 2026 be the hottest year ever? Will Bitcoin be 200K by next year? U.S.-Iran nuclear meltdown this year? Government shutdown in 2026. Will Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce get married before January 1st, 2027? Will Paul Thomas Anderson win an Oscar? Will wages be above inflation in 2026? Will there be a recession in 2026? Will there be more tech layoffs in 2026 than in 2025? Will egg prices go up by December 2026? Will ASAP Rocky release Don't Be Dumb before Saturday? Will a human land on Mars before California starts high-speed rail? Just some of the many questions posed to this theoretical 8-ball toy. Now to the article. Jack DeShane was doing serious volume on the Pope market. DeShane is 25 years old, and by his own account, knows next to nothing about the papal conclave. Yet in May 2025, as cardinals locked themselves inside the Sistine Chapel to decide who would inherit the throne of St. Peter after the death of Pope Francis, DeShane was on a website called Kalshi, buying and selling contracts worth some $30,000 on the various outcomes of who might win the papacy. These odds were driven less by Vatican intrigue than by straightforward mathematical calculation. For most of the conclave, the Chicago guy, the future Pope Leo XIV, was trading between like 1 and 5 cents, says DeShane. To predict the odds of various cardinals becoming pope, DeShane was not even using particularly fancy math, he tells me. This is math you can find on Wikipedia. DeShane had become so consumed by papal market making that he was falling behind on his studies at Princeton, where he was writing a thesis on game theory. Still, it seemed financially irresponsible to devote any time at all to classwork, given that DeShane could net some $10,000 on the Pope market alone in a single week. In a single year on Kalshi, DeShane estimates he's made $1.5 million. I met DeShane in the summer of 2025 at a Kalshi happy hour held at a dimly lit pub in Greenwich Village. The prediction market startup, newly flush with venture cash, had invited its most active users, or to one organizer who kept calling them all the top dorks, to swap trading tips over beer and sliders. They were dressed down guys in t-shirts, mostly in their early 20s, who were earning fortunes on a marketplace that, until recently, had existed in a legal gray zone. Many were making thousands a week speculating on highly specific fixations. Whether the temperature would tick up by a single degree in Colorado next weekend. Who would win the Coney Island hot dog eating contest? The gender of celebrity babies. It may sound silly, but many of the hardcore nerds at the center of this movement saw something larger taking shape, an experiment in collective intelligence with the potential to upend not only Wall Street, but the inner workings of American democracy. Yet only one person there mentioned the dirty word that everyone else had so carefully avoided. A little guy in the corner with especially large teeth, a thick Eastern European accent, and a few sparse hairs attempting to cloak his balding forehead had been swirling a glass of ice and cryptically dodging my basic questions. For instance, what his name was. I'd been riffing about prediction markets with him when he leaned in close, his mouth full of cheeseburger. "You're writing about this, but you have no idea what this meeting is, do you?" "What is it?" I asked, leaning back to avoid his spittle. "This," he said, taking in the barroom of traders, "is just the latest Gamblers Anonymous meeting." Back in 2016, just about everyone on Wall Street wanted exposure to two things, Trump winning the election and Brexit. At the time, Tariq Mansour, an MIT grad with a perpetual 5 o'clock shadow, was working as an analyst at Goldman Sachs and creating bundles of stock options that attempted to predict what might happen if Trump won or Brexit passed. This, as it turned out, was the financial equivalent of reading tea leaves through a Bloomberg terminal. The clumsiness of this exercise sparked Mansour to wonder, what if we create a financial market that prices questions about the future the same way you price a stock? Not long after, Mansour began sketching out an idea for a new kind of financial market, a cleaner, more direct version of the one he'd been simulating inside Goldman. It would do what markets at their best have always done, distill collective belief into a price. If it worked, Mansour reasoned that it stood to become the most consequential market ever built, because it would be concerned with questions that preoccupy everyone. The stock market prices corporate futures. Mansour wanted to build a market that priced the future itself. The result was Kalshi, a company he launched in July 2021 with his co-founder, Brazilian-born fellow MIT grad and former ballerina Luana Lopez Lara, a marketplace that would make truth tradable. There was, however, one minor obstacle. The kind of market Kalshi wanted to build was illegal, at least according to the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So Mansour and Lopez Lara did what any enterprising startup founders might do. They sued the federal government. Thus began a slog of bureaucratic skirmishes that unfolded over the course of 3 years. The decisive blow came in October 2024, when Kalshi won the right to host an election market weeks before the nation's next presidential vote. This development, more than any other, vaulted prediction markets into the national conversation, bringing in more than $100 million in wagers. On Polymarket, another prediction market and Kalshi's crypto-based competitor, traders put up a staggering $3.2 billion in wagers. Suddenly, what had seemed like a niche experiment was becoming a financial reality. Since then, the bets have kept on coming. Kalshi currently hosts more than 2,000 markets, ranging from headline events to the absurdly specific. The big idea, according to Mansour, is that these markets give us the ability to see the future more clearly. They are a mechanism for us to get a little bit smarter, he says. Imagine a world where, if we're debating on whether climate change is real, and you're screaming, "No, it's absolutely not real," and I'm screaming, "Climate change is 100% real, you're full of shit." There's a market where people have real money on the line, saying that there's a 70% chance that next year is going to be hotter than this year. And we have this objective, unbiased, filtered source of truth for what the future holds. The reason these markets are so useful to society is because people have skin in the game. In many ways, these markets are nothing new. Americans have been betting on election outcomes as far back as the Lincoln era. In the 1930s, political wagers sometimes outpaced trading in stocks and bonds. Voting has always been a sort of gaming, like checkers or backgammon, Henry David Thoreau wrote in 1849, and betting naturally accompanies it. Markets also tend to be good at prediction. An election market created by three economists at the University of Iowa in 1988 beat the polls in at least three elections, and on Wall Street, futures markets have proved very good at forecasting. Considering this brief history, it's somewhat curious that prediction markets haven't gained wider traction. Other examples of future markets, like the Hollywood Stock Exchange, launched in 1996 to let traders wager on box office results and predict it, a forecasting site founded in 2014, have repeatedly faced pushback from both institutions and regulators. But today's prediction market boom seems destined to last for two reasons. The first is that these markets have found unusually warm support in Washington under the second Trump administration, where they are treated like the hottest new civic innovation project. Next photo, risky rainmaker. Kaushi chief Tarek Mansour on stage at Web Summit 2021 in Portugal sued to get prediction markets decriminalized in the U.S. Devin Nunes, the former congressman and current CEO of Trump Media and Technology Group, has described them as tools that empower everyday Americans to harness the wisdom of the crowd. Donald Trump Jr. serves as a special advisor to both Kaushi and Polymarket. And in October, Truth Social announced plans to launch a prediction market of its own, called Truth Predict. The second reason is subtler. Prediction markets are gaining momentum in an era when experts have burned through their authority, institutional knowledge is almost universally scorned, and shared reality is splintering into an algorithmic hall of mirrors. The pollsters miss the polls. The networks can't agree on the facts. And Trump's government is backpedaling on two centuries' worth of scientific consensus. Perhaps these problems can be solved by putting a price on truth and turning it into a commodity. It's a very elegant, very free market-based approach, says Mansour. We're giving a financial incentive, rewarding people that have valuable information for society to bring into the marketplace. Already, these markets are viewed as a convincing barometer for truth. Saul Munn, a 22-year-old who studies philosophy at Berkeley and hosts forecasting events at universities, tells me that when he wants to know what's going on in the world, he is more likely to check the odds on Kaushi than watch CNN. The traders make a lot of money from being right, he says. One guy is incentivized to get clicks. The other guy is incentivized to make money. Never mind that prediction markets often rely on reporting from CNN to settle their bets. While boosters promise tidy yes or no wagers, in practice, traders sometimes spend days parsing ambiguous contracts in Kalshi's and Polymarket's Discord servers. Perhaps the most famous example of this was a bet on Polymarket that asked whether Volodymyr Zelensky would wear a suit by a certain date. When the Ukrainian president stepped out in a tailored-looking outfit, traders tore one another apart, debating the definition of the word suit. The market, which ultimately determined its outcome through what the company described as credible reporting, resolved to know, to no one's lasting satisfaction. Despite all the ambiguity, prediction markets' biggest backers, Silicon Valley venture capitalists, remain undeterred. It used to be that the medium was the message. In Silicon Valley, the line has been updated. The markets are the message, says one venture communications executive. That gospel has set off a frenzy. Since the election, so many people have started building prediction markets, says Arad Gishri, an investor based in Portugal. Some of these people are founders whose products didn't catch on, and so they pivoted to prediction. It's like dozens and dozens and dozens, like really a lot, and it's still happening. Gishri, too, has caught the bug. Earlier this year, he left his job as a venture capitalist to start his own prediction market called Lightcone Labs. According to prototypes I've seen and conversations I've had with dozens of traders and founders, the future of these markets looks something like this. Every news story will come with a trade button beside it. Podcast will let listeners bet live as the host talk. NFL broadcast will flash odds on whether the next pass will be caught. Even reality dating shows will come with tickers predicting which couples are most likely to find love. In other words, every conviction will have a price. Boosters believe prediction markets could also double as a kind of idiosyncratic insurance for an increasingly unstable world. If you booked a beach vacation in Florida, for instance, and worried a hurricane might ruin it, you could hedge the risk by betting on the storm and recouping your losses on the weather market. If traditional insurers won't touch your California home, you could still place a sizable wager on the odds of a wildfire creeping into your neighborhood. This is going to be as big as equity markets, commodity markets, derivatives markets, says Tony Gemile, who has worked at both Kalshi and Poly Market. I think of them as opinion markets, and everybody has an opinion on something. The issue with both Kalshi and Poly Market, Gemile says, is that they generate their own markets, built around news cycles, elections, sporting events, and the occasional trader suggestion. Gemile plans to solve for this by, yes, building his own prediction market called the Clearing Company, which gives anyone the ability to create any kind of market they can imagine. According to Gemile, the Clearing Company will be far better than any kind of futures markets that currently exist on Wall Street. Years ago, Gemile met a guy in Seattle who got so good at modeling the weather that he now wins 95% of weather markets. To do so, he built a bespoke network of weather stations. Good luck to somebody at Citadel who wants to trade against this guy because he will beat them, Gemile says. This, to me, is the cool thing about prediction markets. Everyone has an area of deep expertise, something that they're way more interested in than somebody on Wall Street ever would be. And it's just really hard to compete against that. The prediction market boom has already cracked open a strange new world of opportunity that rewards obsession, precision, and niche expertise. In the months I reported this story, I met a stay-at-home mom in Alabama who studied meteorology in college and made $20,000 betting on 1 and 2 degree temperature swings in Denver. Today, she's known as Weather Shannon and works as an operations specialist for Kalshi. I met young men in their early 20s who quit their jobs as Wall Street quants to create market-making firms. Why would you work at Goldman when you can work at Kalshi? Ask a communications advisor who works with the company. This is the next generation of finance. But the most successful of all was a former poker player based in Las Vegas, who tells me he's cleared $2.8 million this year betting on politics. His strategy involves watching C-SPAN 16 hours a day. We are entering a brave new world in which every headline, celebrity scandal, and twist of global politics can, will, be bought, sold, and wagered on. The downstream effects are already well on their way. In December, Kalshi struck a deal with CNN and CNBC to broadcast live tickers on air. Turning the news into a real-time market with a Kalshi logo attached. In January, the Golden Globes featured a Poly Market integration, with announcers frequently mentioning the odds of various races as a ticker flashed on screen. The cultural shift is so seismic that the venture firm Andreessen Horowitz believes it is poised to become the single organizing principle of the next era. Prediction is now the entire game, writes the firm's editor-at-large, Alex Danko, in a company blog post. It is the movement and meta-aesthetic that defines our main branch of society going forward. Prediction is as significant a concept as modernism and postmodernism. It's the defining reframe of our generation, and we'd better understand it. Their most zealous supporters envision prediction markets as a new framework for governing. In Silicon Valley, this idea is having a moment thanks to Robin Hanson, a prickly economist who years ago introduced the concept of futarchy, a system that would route government decisions through the cool logic of betting markets. In a paper that he first released in 2000, Hanson laid out a blueprint for a government that passes laws only when markets predict they will increase national welfare. The major problem of modern government, he argues, is that countries and democracies fail largely by not aggregating available information. One of the first people who mentions the idea of futarchy to me is a pseudonymous programmer in San Francisco who goes only by the name Prophet, and he spells it P-R-O-P-H-3-T. He is a self-described super-anon crypto type. When he does make public appearances, he typically uses a voice distorter and wears a bronze cyborgian mask with two glowing blue eyes. Lately, he's slightly relaxed the anonymity. On the day we speak over the phone, he is not using a voice distorter. He sounds exactly how I expected him to, like a nerdy white guy in his late 20s or early 30s. Next photo, fortune teller. Feds raided the apartment of Polymarket founder Shane Kaplan after his site correctly called the 2024 election. About 3 years ago, Prophet launched a company called MetaDAO, which he describes as civilization's first futarchy. The company relies on markets to reach all of its key decisions, like whether it should seek outside investment. Like other futarchy evangelists, Prophet believes that markets are a sleek, superior upgrade to the clunky machinery of government. This is not democracy, he says. It's a new thing. It's better. While democracy has been an improvement on other forms of government, it's still pretty structurally flawed, Prophet continues, and markets don't have that problem, right? People that work in markets know all these intricate, fine-grained details about the companies they're analyzing because they can make money by having that information. Prophet's vision might sound fringe, but it's closer to the center of power than it appears. It's the same logic that animates one of the industry's rising stars, Shane Copeland, the curly-haired founder of Polymarket, who has retained a kind of industry bad boy allure ever since federal agents raided his apartment after Polymarket correctly called the presidential race in November 2024. No legal action was taken against Copeland or Polymarket. Futarchy is one of my favorite ideas that exist, Copeland tells me over Zoom call last summer. It is a difficult sell, but the idea of using markets to aid decision-making in pursuit of optimizing for some final variable that is a metric that represents what people want or what's good for the body that's being governed is super exciting. When I ask if he thinks we are on a path to futarchy becoming a tool of governance, he doesn't hesitate. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't think we were. It's seductive to see prediction markets as creating a gleaming world through pooled information and the cold clarity of bets. This vision posits that we all might be better off in a meritocratic republic of sharpshooters, placing elegant little wagers on the truths that will supposedly steer us toward a greater public good. The reality is more human and a lot stupider. These markets are kind of janky, John Oberlander, who trades on Kalshi, tells me, Aside from a bunch of markets that aren't that liquid, there are the usual teething pains of fast-growing startups. Glitchy sites, outages, weird edge case complaints that happen when you build something that was barely legal a few years ago. Then there are the complaints that cut directly against the high-minded mission prediction markets like to project. For all the talk of surfacing truth and harnessing collective intelligence, most of the volume on these sites comes from one of the oldest forms of gambling there is, sports betting. Nearly 90% of volume on prediction markets comes directly from sports contracts, and the sector has grown quickest in states that prohibit it, thanks to a convenient regulatory workaround. The cynical take is, wow, they came up with the word prediction markets to now offer gambling for the 50 states who didn't really sign up for this, says Oberlander. They have to do all sorts of theatrics to get the regulation and the tax treatment they want. But everyone who's invested in it can see what's happening here. When I ask Mansoor if Kalshi might just be a more polished spin on gambling, he says that he disagrees with the question's premise. We don't think it's gambling, he says. We just don't. And in the places where it really does look like gambling, what Kalshi provides is actually an ethical upgrade, according to Mansoor. On sports books, users bet against the house. On Kalshi, they bet against each other. Sure, Kalshi skims a transaction fee off the top of any trade, but we don't have any incentive for you to lose money, he says. Whether regulators buy that argument is another question. In late November, Kalshi was hit with a class action lawsuit accusing the company of running misleading, unlicensed sports gambling. Then again, what are financial markets if not nation-sized gambles dressed up in spreadsheets? For believers like Gamal, prediction markets aren't a deviation so much as a cleaner, smarter upgrade. Derivatives, in my mind, is just a fancy word for gambling, says Gamal. You know, a lot of what Wall Street is doing is a lot closer to betting than I think the average American realizes. Now we move on to California, the overlord's underdog. Between Elon Musk and Sam Altman in their Silicon Valley battle royal stands Mark Toberoff, a Malibu lawyer who'd rather be a movie producer, if only his name didn't send some studio brass into fits. Tom Doughton sits down with the ultimate Hollywood litigator. Photographer Ryan Pfluger contributed to this article. Opening photo shows Mark Toberoff dressed in a suit, sitting in a chair by an infinity pool. In June 2024, the Hollywood attorney Mark Toberoff was in the fitness room of his Malibu home, barking into the phone that Elon Musk needed to withdraw his lawsuit against Sam Altman and OpenAI immediately. Toberoff had just begun advising Musk's legal team on the recommendation of Ari Emanuel, a mutual friend. OpenAI's lawyers had filed a motion to dismiss, on which a judge was going to hear arguments the following day. Toberoff wanted to file a new case, a bigger one, but if the judge ruled against Musk now, it could haunt what came next. From his yoga mat at 6 a.m, the litigator was emphatic, pull it now. Musk pulled it just hours before the hearing. Weeks later, Toberoff took over the case, and early that August he filed a new complaint, this time in federal court, with 15 counts, including fraud and RICO statutes. Toberoff, a movie producer with credits on Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, and Bad Boys, Ride or Die, wrote the new complaint like a movie logline. Elon Musk case against Sam Altman and OpenAI is a textbook tale of altruism versus greed, it reads. The perfidy and deceit are of Shakespearean proportions. The case is headed to trial in April and has become the tip of the spear in the bitter feud between Musk, the richest man in the world, and Altman, the man he entrusted with humanity's AI future. At stake is the fate of OpenAI, the now half-trillion-dollar company they co-founded a decade ago that has almost single-handedly kicked off the AI revolution. If Musk prevails, the court could undo the company's delicate restructuring of its for-profit arm, a decision that would jeopardize tens of billions in investor funding. Failing that, Musk is seeking one of the biggest financial judgments in history. Wrongful gains that reflect what he says his stake should be worth, given he was OpenAI's biggest early investor. Even if he loses on the merits, the trial itself will be a spectacle. Two billionaires facing off in front of an Oakland jury, airing all the bitterness and resentment that have been building for years. Musk is a veteran of jury testimonies. For Altman, this will be his first. That Toberoff would be in the middle of this legal battle surprises nearly everyone, no one more than him. He was not on a first-name basis with the big tech names at play, having spent most of his career as a creature of Hollywood. He met with Vanity Fair a few times last fall, twice at a family Italian restaurant in a Malibu shopping center, once over Zoom from his East 64th Street apartment, a Wassily Kandinsky print on the wall behind him. It was his first experience sitting for extended interviews about himself. Initially nervous, he eventually warmed to the project and began offering creative direction. Would it be possible, he asked, to do a photo shoot with a rented dog? He joked it would make him more relatable. He's lived in Malibu for more than 25 years with his wife, Dahlia, an interior designer with whom he has four children. Their first house in Malibu burned down in a 2007 wildfire. His current one, in the coastal range above the Pacific Coast Highway, has expansive ocean views, and once the construction is finished, an infinity pool. He also has a place in the Hamptons, bought, he says, long before he could afford it. A slight figure with restless light blue eyes, Toporov looks like a cross between Sam Rockwell and Ethan Coen, or perhaps an older version of Altman himself. I can just imagine the other side looking at me up and going, "Who is this guy?" Toporov says. "But I've been underestimated before. In fact, that's my secret weapon." At early court appearances for the OpenAI case, Toporov squared off against more than a dozen attorneys from Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen and Katz, Morrison and Forster, and Deschert. Sometimes he had one associate, sometimes he was alone. "I kind of like the imagery, you know," he says. "OpenAI's attorneys say they're unimpressed." Mr. Musk's lawsuit continues to be noise without substance and is all part of his ongoing pattern of harassment, and we look forward to demonstrating this at trial, OpenAI's lead counsel William Savitt says in a statement. He added that the company won't be distracted by these theatrics. If Silicon Valley doesn't know Toporov, Hollywood certainly does. Depending on whom you ask, he's either a Robin Hood of forgotten creators and their heirs, or a scorched earth negotiator who holds projects hostage until studios pay him and his clients and give him a producer credit. Ask Toporov what he does, and he'll say he's a producer first. He's made a living and a formidable IMDb page by helping writers and their heirs reclaim rights that were signed away decades ago. A provision of copyright law lets creators and their families take back what they gave to studios. Many don't even know they can reclaim them until he reaches out. Several people who've worked with him said he was known to pull out a list with the 100-plus properties his clients control a critical piece of. They include Predator, Friday the 13th, the Clarice Starling and Hannibal Lecter characters from The Silence of the Lambs, Bloodsport, Psycho, Porky's, Hellraiser, and the Thomas Crown Affair. Sometimes getting back the rights for his clients takes years, but rather than charge by the hour, he typically works on contingency. He commissions a portion of the rights fee if and when a project gets made, and if he can, he negotiates getting credited and paid as a producer. One studio executive describes the lunch meetings with Toporov, where he'll produce the list and walk you through what he controls. "It's almost like going to a market. The guy opens his jacket with all these different watches. That's Mark with his IP. Several studio executives see him essentially as a copyright troll. An executive at an indie studio writes him off as an ambulance chaser. Others say they refuse to work with him because of his uncompromising style. Some won't even touch a property if they know he's involved. You make a deal, he agrees, and at the very end he changes his mind and goes on and on and on," one executive says. "It's bananas." Toporov says he's merely enforcing rights Congress gave authors and their heirs in the Copyright Act. "This is an ambulance chasing where someone's had an accident," he says. "No, somebody actually created this property." He's almost an exaggeration of relentlessness. In 2002, a barista at the Starbucks inside a Calabasas Barnes & Noble gave Toporov's wife a 2-full cup of coffee that spilled on their 20-month-old son. Toporov sued. The case was dismissed. He appealed. 8 years later, he won the right to a new trial. Barnes & Noble eventually settled. Emmanuel, whom he's known for several decades and who is one of Toporov's biggest supporters, says his results speak for themselves, though Toporov can be a pain even for him. Sometimes he's the scorpion. "Oh, take me to the other side of the road." And then he bites you. There's nothing you can do about it. Toporov doesn't comfortably fit the town's image of a lawyer. He has flashes of old Hollywood flair, calling a former boss, a Ganef, a studio chief, an Alterkocker, and rattling off old Variety headlines as if they were obvious cultural touchstones. Toberoff set sail with Fantasy Island, but he also shows an appealing lack of polish that falls between candor and obliviousness. He's kind of like a Curb Your Enthusiasm character, one executive at a major studio says. Another recalled meeting with him at a West Side steakhouse to celebrate closing a big deal. He wanted to share the steak, which I thought was, at the time, slightly odd. Toberoff was raised in a lawyer's house. His father was a first-generation Jewish immigrant who grew up poor in Brooklyn and went on to become the king of medical malpractice law in New York, trying more than 300 cases. He was known for his brutal cross-examinations of expert witnesses, Toberoff says. He would reduce them into an oil slick. That approach carried over to the dinner table. "Why didn't I take out the garbage? Why didn't I do this?" he says. "I grew up being cross-examined." He also grew up rich, lived in Westport, Connecticut, spent summers at the family house in France. His father gambled in Monte Carlo and drove a Lamborghini Countach well into his 70s. His mother was an intellectual, a German Jew whose family fled the Nazis, named him after Marc Chagall. She limited TV and comic books, but took Toberoff and his sister to the arthouse cinema every weekend to watch Bertolucci and Fellini. After initially resisting law school, Toberoff eventually applied to Columbia and had the misfortune of getting in. He found that he enjoyed studying copyright law, feeling it brought him closer to the arts his mom instilled. After passing the bar, he took a grueling job with storied New York law firm Kelly Dry & Warren. Once, after pulling an all-nighter, he got into an argument with a partner and was fired. "He was giving me problems," Toberoff says. "I don't do well with authority." Following a stint at an entertainment law firm, Toberoff realized he wanted to work in the movie industry. He wrote a letter to director Robert Altman, pitching himself for a job. The auteur took him on to handle business affairs in New York, but it was a disaster. When a screaming match nearly ended in a fistfight, the director was famously into drugs, booze, and gambling at the time, Toberoff quit. Still wanting to make movies, he went to the New York Public Library and researched producers' names, landing on Elliot Kastner, the prolific producer behind films like The Long Goodbye. Toberoff again wrote a letter. "Dear Mr. Kastner, attached is my illustrious resume. Teach me how to make movies. I'll cut your legal bills in half." He got the job and spent the next few years as Kastner's gopher, picking him up at the airport, answering phones, and hanging around sets as 80s stars like Mickey Rourke and Lisa Bonet drifted through. It soon became clear why Kastner had answered his letter. The producer was drowning in lawsuits from people claiming he double-crossed them or owed them money. Next, he tried his hand at producing an indie film, Sons, with Jennifer Beals, and directed by her then-husband. To find a distributor, he went to Cannes during the film festival and paid kids to plaster the Croisette with posters at 4 a.m., Toberoff says the movie got distribution. Barely. He then moved out to Los Angeles with Dahlia. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. You can also listen by telling your smart device to play NC Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.